Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. Because I was unable to preach last week, we missed the Israelite crossing through the Reed Sea or the Red Sea, and we'll be in the Ten Commandments until Advent now, one commandment each week. The commandment seems to begin in a very straightforward manner. And God spoke all these words, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." Now, this seems obvious in a way that things that we hear repeatedly spoken to us seem obvious. But if you think about it, a bunch of things emerge. We're told to have no other gods before him. Are there other gods? Is that what this thing is saying? Skeptics will ask about there being any gods, and what does it mean to have these gods before him? Now, this is actually an introduction to a rather formal ceremony, and it might not appear obvious unless, of course, you go back and take a look at chapter 19. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." I sometimes wonder if this is where Tolkien gets his escape practice in The Hobbit and in The Lord of the Rings, because every time it seems the crew gets in real trouble, the eagles come and carry them out on eagle's wings, and it seems to resolve everything. But what's interesting is that God brought them to himself. That's a critical feature here. "Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." And so it's quite clear that God has brought them out into the desert to be his. In some ways, you might say to be married to him, to be God's faithful wife. That is what Israel is supposed to be. And that imagery gets picked up again and again in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament prophets. Now, they are to be his treasured possession, something that he values. "Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Israel is, in that sense, to sort of be a go-between between the God who owns the whole world, and they are to embody his witness to the world. And those of you who understand a little bit about what happens in the book of Acts, and you will be my witnesses, can see that in many ways the same situation is set up, and Israel is to be God's witness to the world, and they will live with him. He has called them out of Egypt to himself to be his treasured possession. And at least initially, that sounds good to everyone. "So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, 'We will do everything the Lord has said.' So Moses brought their answer back to God." Well, it seems like everything is going well so far. Now, John Walton, who was a scholar at Wheaton of Old Testament, especially other ancient Near East cultures, makes this note about covenant. "One of the most crucial concepts to understand ancient Israelite religion and the theology of the Old Testament is that of the covenant. The Hebrew word for covenant, berit, essentially means a binding legal agreement, sort of like a contract, and can refer to agreements in a wide variety of contexts, including personal, familial, business, and international settings. Other Near East societies utilize the same sorts of agreements, many of which have survived to this day. The covenant established at Sinai between the Lord and the Israelites is both like and unlike those more ordinary agreements that were necessary for the effective functioning of these societies." Walton goes on to say that what follows is traditionally called the Ten Commandments. There is no exact parallel to this list from other ancient Near East societies. Although a few texts represent similarities, such texts are not legal texts, however. One Sumerian wisdom text known as the Instructions to Shurupak offers advice on how to conduct a happy and productive life. And you can see some examples of the kinds of commands. Don't extend a house too close to the public square. It will cause an obstruction. Don't steal anything. Don't kill yourself. My son, don't commit murder. Don't laugh with a girl if she is married. The slander arising from it is strong. Don't plan lies. It is discrediting. Don't speak fraudulently. In the end, it will bind you like a trap. Now, many people have noted the common wisdom that's in many of these ancient legal or advice texts and said, well, look, it sort of talks about the same thing. Well, there are things that are similar. Don't have sexual intercourse with your slave girl. She will neglect you. That's not one we find in the Ten Commandments. Don't drive away a debtor. That man may turn hostile towards you. Don't rape a man's daughter. The courtyard will find out about you. And so, but you can see, you can read in ancient documents, similar types of lists of rules. Another text comes from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, Spell 125. It describes how a man might obtain a blissful life after death. The deceased is to declare his innocence by naming nearly 80 actions he did not commit. These include actions prescribed by the Ten Commandments. I have not robbed. I have not been envious. I have not killed people. I have not copulated with a man's wife. I have not debased the god in my town. And on has a whole variety, 80 some of these, that at the end of your life you have to swear that you haven't committed. This is a pretty high standard. But now, as with the Ten Commandments, John Walton goes on, such lists summarize a number of basic principles believed to be characteristic of one who has led a just and upright life. And the Ten Commandments, in fact, do that, but I think categorically they're quite different even from these ancient laws and wisdom texts. The Code of Hammurabi is one of the more famous ones. It was found on this stele where Hammurabi is receiving the laws from God, and there's quite a few laws that he receives. And so I decided to go and find them, because you can find these things on the internet, and at least include laws 1 through 3. Notice how they start. If a man bring an accusation against a man and charge him with a capital crime, but cannot prove it, he, the accuser, shall be put to death. Seems somewhat fair. If a man charge a man with sorcery and cannot prove it, he who is charged with sorcery shall go to the river. Into the river he shall throw himself, and if the river overcome him, his accuser shall take to himself the house or the estate. If the river show that the man be innocent, this is sort of trial by river. If the river show the man to be innocent, and he come forth unharmed, he who charged him with sorcery shall be put to death. This is something like Monty Python's witch trial. He who threw himself into the river shall take to himself the house of his accuser. Now again, if you sort of understand the law of retribution, you can kind of understand this, but this is a very different thing from what we find in the Ten Commandments, especially how it begins. The Ten Commandments, in fact, seem quite unique compared to these other things. Notice the focus. Notice how it begins with what is, in many respects, the logical beginnings. The 10 words, as they're often called, doesn't look dated like anything that we're finding in these texts. The 10 Commandments actually looks quite contemporary and quite usable today, which is a mark of, I think, its truth. And we don't really find anything that quite compares to it. Well, why? Well, this is actually a pivotal moment in the whole story of the Bible. The Bible begins with God making a good world, and as many have noted, the story of this world making is very different from what you found in the stories of Israel's neighbor. This isn't a story of there being a conscious sun god and a conscious moon god and conscious earth gods that have to be propitiated and bowed down to. These are the gods that are mentioned. You shall have no other god before me, because most of the nations around imagined the world to be replete with gods. And now, in the Ten Commandments, it doesn't say these gods don't exist, but in many ways, the text sort of implies there's no one there worth talking to. Of course, in Genesis 3, you have the rebellion of the image bearers, and it's followed by the exile of the image bearers from the garden. the corruption of their children, Cain and Abel, one kills the other. And as the story continues, there's a slide into chaos. The world gets worse and worse. Finally, God decides to step in and clean up this mess, and he does what many people think is the best way to go about this. He decides to separate the good from the bad, but he's pretty picky, and so he selects the very best man he can find and saves his family, because of course he would be miserable if he killed his children along with all of their neighbors, and saves them from the flood with an ark. As it turns out, however, that Noah, once he gets out of the ark, plants a vineyard and can't hold his wine. And his son laughs at his nakedness, sees his nakedness, and is then cursed. Things continue to get worse with the Tower of Babel. God starts a new beginning with the call of Abram, and he's going to take this one family. And you would think if he's starting a nation out of one family, he'd pick a particularly fertile couple, but in fact he picks a couple that can't seem to have a baby at all, and promises them a child. As the story goes on, the child is born, and God tells him to sacrifice this child, but at the last minute, there's a reprieve, and a ram is killed instead of Isaac. A generation later, we will find God wrestling with Jacob. God keeps trying to bless Jacob, but Jacob seemingly won't be blessed by himself or won't allow God to bless without some kind of a bargain, and so they wrestle, and Jacob is renamed to Israel, he who wrestles with God. Jacob's sons are quarrelsome, and in fact, 11 or 10 of the sons sell the 11th son into slavery in Egypt by his brother, because apparently the only thing better than beating up your brother and throwing him into a cistern and maybe killing him is getting some money out of him by selling him to the cousins who are traveling over to Egypt. God then rescues the world through this son that has been sold into slavery. You begin to notice the themes start to build up here, and rescues the world through Joseph, who is a teller of dreams, and the whole earth is fed in Egypt. And so the whole family goes to Egypt, and they all live in Egypt. But there's a change in administration, and the Israelites are enslaved, and Pharaoh tries a variety of brutal ways to subjugate them and eliminate them. God hears their cries, and God comes in and chooses them as his chosen possession. He calls Moses. He humiliates the gods of Empire Egypt, these gods that all of the nations around feel are worth talking to and can hear them. God in that way sort of sweeps out the middle and says, nope, I am the only one to talk to. You shall have no other gods before me. God, the sermon we missed out last week, God destroys the army of Empire Egypt. And God makes good on his promise to free Israel. And now they are finally at this appointment in the desert to worship him. And he says, I will take you to be my wife. I will take you to be my people. But you have to agree to a covenant. You have to agree to obey and live the way I want you to live so that the world may know who I am. Israel assembles in the desert. Israel assembles to worship God directly. He comes down on the mountain and promises to obey. And God appears in glory. This is one of the incidences of a theophany, or the day of the Lord. There's darkness and lightning and thunder, and the people are told to stay back from the mountain or they will surely die. And God speaks from the mountain directly to the people, and the first word out of his mouth is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. We are fulfilling the covenant today. You might even see it as a wedding ceremony. And the people say, I do. Okay. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other God before me. This will be an exclusive relationship. It's the first word that begins the relationship, and the entire relationship is built upon it. What this God is completely different from all of the other gods that Israel has seen before, all of the other gods that Israel knew in Egypt, all of the other gods that Israel will find in the other land. And the Lord says, I will be your first and only. That's the only way this marriage is going to work. And this God is different. As I noted before, scholars have, in comparing, it hasn't been too long since we found many of these other ancient texts, the God of Israel is different from all the other gods. All the other gods are sort of like superheroes buzzing about in an impersonal space. But this God, in a sense, is both the space and the agent within the space. The creation story isn't about a bunch of smaller gods you need to cut side deals with. There are other spiritual beings, but this one is supreme and alone to be worshipped. This God is the central character of the story from beginning to the end. He is the Alpha and the Omega. Apart from this God, there is no life worth having or keeping. He is reaching out to redeem his rebellious, fallen creation, and he has chosen Israel to be his witnesses. Now, even though just in chapter 19, Israel on the altar says, "We do," if you look at the few chapters that I skipped in between here and the story of the plagues, well, even in the courtship, even in the engagement period, there were troubling signs. There has already been trouble. There will be greater trouble still as this relationship gets going. Was Israel sincere in making the promise? I have no reason to believe she wasn't. People commonly make very sincere promises they're unable to keep. The real question is, will Israel be capable of keeping this promise? And throughout the long story of what Christians call the Old Testament, the answer will be no. And so what happens in the New Testament is that God finds a way for Israel to keep the covenant. Israel needs a new representative who can come and fulfill Israel's side of the bargain, one who will be totally committed to God because he himself will be God. Someone will have to uphold Israel's end of the covenant for her and even, frankly, bear the price of the penalties that the covenant enlisted. Someone will have to uphold our end of the covenant for us. The Gospel of Matthew in chapter 2 makes this note. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." The Christian story is that Jesus fulfills the calling of Israel. Jesus fulfills the covenant Israel could not. But where does that leave us? Does the covenant, do we just set it aside now? How do we relate to the Ten Commandments today? This is the Lord our God who delivered us from Egypt out of the house of bondage. Now you might say, well, I've never been to Egypt. But you'll notice there's a lot of symbolic standing in as these stories go. And so in that sense, the Exodus out of Egypt is our Exodus. It comes to us through Christ. We shall have no other gods before him. Our marriage to him, our relationship with him must be pure. Now, as I mentioned earlier, most moderns use this text to preach against idolatry because many secular people struggle to believe in one God, never mind a polytheistic world of gods. But there are many other things that tend to stand in and replace God. And so what this commandment is about is loyalty and fidelity that covers our entire life. But you'll notice the word on top of the slide here is gratitude. We do not do this to qualify for membership of God's family. That has been done for us in Christ. We do this, in fact, to express our gratitude to Christ for what he has done. The Heidelberg Catechism is a document that in the Christian Reformed Church we use and have used for quite a while. And this document has a treatment of the Ten Commandments. And we will be referring to it as we go through this series. What does the Lord require in His first commandment? That I, not wanting to endanger my salvation, avoid and shun all idolatry, sorcery, superstitious rites, and prayer to the saints, and to other creatures. That I rightly know the only true God, trust Him alone, and look to God for every good thing, humbly and patiently, and love, fear, and honor God with all my heart. In short, that I give up anything rather than go against God's will in any way. What is idolatry? This is their answer to the first commandment. What is the application of this? Idolatry is having or inventing something in which one trusts in place of or alongside of the only true God who has revealed Himself in the Word.